Chapter 12, Racial Prejudice Charge.
Conley is guilty. He's the real murderer, not Frank. And he's seeking to save his own black skin by charging the crime to the factory superintendent.
Those were the words shouted by hundreds of Atlanteans for the first few days after the Negro had made his sensational affidavit. And, of course, the friends of Frank shouted the charge against the Negro loudest.
"What's the matter with the detectives?"
asked those who thought the Negro not an accessory but a principal in the crime.
"What's the matter with Dorsey? Why doesn't he make a move?"
Dorsey remained calm and quiet under the criticisms, and the detectives clung to the theory that Frank was the murderer, and generally they accepted the story of Jim Conley as being the truth, if not the whole truth.
"Dorsey is prejudiced against the Jew, and so are the detectives."
This was a statement which one could hear during those turbulent days on every street corner in Atlanta, in every saloon, in every club, and everywhere men gathered to discuss the great murder mystery. The detectives continued to cling to their theory, and the storm of criticism didn't move the Solicitor General. It was not without its effect, however. And the same grand jury which had indicted Frank for the Mary Fagan murder sought to indict the Negro for the same crime. If it had, Frank would probably never have faced a trial for his life. But Dorsey stood firm, and at every grand jury meeting he blocked the efforts to indict the Negro.
"We have Conley locked up," he told the grand jurymen,
"and he has no more chance of escaping now than he would have if charged with the murder. No bond will be big enough to get him out of jail. Frank is already indicted, and I am firm in my conviction that he is guilty of the crime. If I am wrong, a jury of 12 men will not convict him, and then there will be plenty of time to talk about indicting Conley." Several of the grand jurors were determined to indict the Negro, and Dorsey continued his protests.
"I am absolutely certain that an indictment of Conley can do no good, and it may cause a miscarriage of justice. In addition, I promise you this. If I remain Solicitor General, Frank will go to trial before Conley."
Finally, the grand jurors took a vote on the advisability of causing the evidence against Conley brought before them. Dorsey won his point. The feeling over the matter was so bitter that one member of the grand jury immediately went before the Superior Court and resigned from the body, declaring that it was prejudiced. Before Frank actually came to trial, another grand jury was impaneled, and over the solicitor's vigorous protest, W.D. Beatty, its foreman, called a meeting to consider the Conley matter. There was another hard and bitter fight, but again Dorsey came out victor. The cry that he was prejudiced became louder, but Dorsey went along undisturbed, devoting practically his entire time to the preparation of the case against Frank. Shortly after Frank was indicted, there came an incident that intensified the hatred of the Frank sympathizers for Dorsey. He heard in a roundabout way that Albert McKnight, husband of Mineola, cook for the Selig family, had sensational evidence in her possession relative to the actions of Frank at home and statements alleged to have been made by members of his family. He sent for Albert and instructed one of his bailiffs to bring Mineola to his office. This was on May 3rd. Albert told the solicitor a sensational story in the presence of his wife, but she refused to corroborate it. Detectives Starnes and Campbell were present at the conference. They questioned the Solicitor General about incarcerating her until they were satisfied that either she or her husband was lying. The solicitor said that it was not in his province to order her incarcerated, but told them to do whatever they thought best. They decided to lock her up, and the negress, screaming and fighting and practically in hysterics, was led to a waiting patrol wagon from Dorsey's office. She remained until June 3rd, when, about noon, when in the presence of Attorney George Gordon, who was retained to represent her by some unknown party, she made the following affidavit. State of Georgia, County of Fulton. Personally appeared before me, a notary public in and for the above state and county, Mineola McKnight, who lives in the rear of 351 Pulliam Street, Atlanta, Georgia, who, being duly sworn, deposes and says, Saturday morning, April 26, 1913, Mr. Frank left home about 8 o'clock, and Albert, my husband, was there Saturday, too. Albert got there, I guess, about 1:15, and was there when Mr. Frank come for dinner, which was about 1:30. But Mr. Frank did not eat any dinner, and he left in about 10 minutes after he got there. Mr. Frank come back to the house at 7 o'clock that night, and Albert was there when he got there. Albert had gone home that evening, but he come back, but I don't know what time he got there, but he come some time before Mr. Frank did, and Mr. Frank eat supper that night about 7 o'clock, and when I left about 8 o'clock, I left Mr. Frank there. Sunday morning, I got there about 8 o'clock, and there was an automobile standing in front of the house, but I didn't pay any attention to it, but I saw a man in the automobile get a bucket of water and pour into it. Miss Lucille, Mr. Frank's wife, was downstairs, and Mr. and Mrs. Zaley were upstairs. Albert was there Sunday morning, but I don't remember what time he got there. When I called them down to breakfast about 8:30, I found that Mr. Frank was gone. Mr. and Mrs. Zaley eat breakfast, and Miss Lucille didn't eat until Mr. Frank come back, and they eat breakfast together. I didn't hear them say anything at the breakfast table, but after dinner I understood them to say that a girl and Mr. Frank were caught at the office Saturday. I don't know who said it, but Miss Lucille and Mr. and Mrs. Zaylig and Mr. Frank was standing there talking after dinner. I didn't know the girl was killed until Monday evening. I understood them to say it was a Jew girl, and I asked Miss Lucille, and she said it was a Gentile. On Tuesday, Mr. Frank said to me, It is mighty bad, Mineola. I might have to go to jail about this girl, and I don't know anything about it. I heard Mrs. Rousen, Mrs. Frank's sister, tell Miss Lucille that it was mighty bad, and Miss Lucille said, Yes, it is. I am going to get after her about it. I don't know what they were talking about. Sunday, Miss Lucille said to Mrs. Salig, that Mr. Frank didn't sleep so good Saturday night. She said he was drunk and wouldn't let her sleep with him, and she said she slept on the floor on the rug by the bed because he was drinking. Miss Lucille said Sunday that Mr. Frank told her Saturday night that he was in trouble, that he didn't know the reason why he would murder, and he told his wife to get his pistol and let him kill himself. I heard Miss Lucille say that to Miss Saley. It got away with Miss Saley mighty bad, but she didn't know what to think. I haven't heard Miss Lucille say whether she believed it or not. I don't know why Mrs. Frank didn't come to see her husband, but it was a pretty good while before she come to see him, maybe 2 weeks. She would tell me, wasn't it mighty bad that he was locked up? And she said, Mineola, I don't know what I'm going to do. When I left home to go to the Solicitor General's office, they told me to mind what I said. They paid me $3.50 a week, but last week she paid me $4, and 1 week she paid me $6.50. But at the time of the murder, I was getting $3.50 a week. And the week right after the murder, I don't remember how much they paid me. Next week, $4, and the next week, $4. 1 week Mrs. Saley gave me $5, but it was not for my work, and they didn't tell me what it was for. They just said, Here's $5, Mineola. But of course, I understood what they meant, but they didn't tell me anything at the time. I understood it was a tip for me to keep quiet. They would tell me to mind how I talked.
Miss Lucille would give me a hat.
Question. Was that the reason you didn't tell the solicitor yesterday all about this? That Miss Lucille and the others had told you not to say anything about what had happened out there?
Yes, sir.
Question. Is that true?
Yes, sir.
Question. And is that the reason why you would rather have been locked up last night than tell this?
Yes, sir.
Question. Has Mr. Pickett or Mr. Craven or Mr. Campbell or myself, Detective Starnes, evidently, influenced you in any way or threatened you in any way to make this statement?
No, sir.
Question. You make it of your own free will and accord, in their presence and the presence of Mr. Gordon, your attorney?
Yes, sir.
Signed, Mineola McKnight. Sworn to and subscribed before me this third day of June, 1913. Signed, G.C. February. Almost immediately after signing the affidavit, Mineola was released from custody, and the following day she repudiated the affidavit. She declared that her husband had told a pack of lies on her, and that the detectives bullied and browbeat her until in sheer desperation she agreed to sign any paper they might fix up for her. The arrest of the cook brought forth the first statement from Mrs. Lucille Selig Frank, wife of the accused, and daughter of one of the most prominent Jews in the South. In her statement she flayed the Solicitor General and the detectives in no uncertain terms. She said, "The action of the Solicitor General in arresting and imprisoning our family cook because she would not voluntarily make a false statement against my innocent husband brings a limit to patience. This wrong is not chargeable to a detective acting under the necessity of shielding his own reputation against attack in newspapers, but of an intelligent, trained lawyer whose sworn duty is as much to protect the innocent as to punish the guilty. My information is that this solicitor has admitted that no crime is charged against this cook, and that he had no legal right to have her arrested and imprisoned." The following statement from the Atlanta Journal undertakes to give the history of the arrest up to the time the woman was carried to the police station in the patrol wagon, weeping and shouting in a hysterical condition. The negress was arrested at the Selig residence shortly after noon Monday upon the order of Solicitor General Hugh M. Dorsey. She was carried to the solicitor's office, and that official, with Detectives Starnes and Campbell, examined her for more than an hour. The woman grew hysterical during the vigorous examination, and finally was led from the solicitor's office to the police patrol, weeping and shouting, "I'm going to hang, and I don't know a thing about it." They tortured her for 4 hours with the well-known third-degree process, in the manner and with the result stated in the Atlanta Constitution of June 4th as follows. Her husband, who was also carried to the police station at noon, was freed a short while before his wife left the prison. He was present during the third degree of 4 hours, under which she was placed in the afternoon. He is said to have declared, even in the presence of his wife, that she had told conflicting stories of Frank's conduct on the tragedy date. After she had been quizzed to a point of exhaustion, Secretary G.C. February, attached to Chief Lanford's office, was summoned to note her statement in full. It was the longest statement made by the woman since her connection with the mystery. It will be used, probably, in the trial. The negress was calm and composed upon emerging from the examination. That the solicitor, sworn to maintain the law, should thus falsely arrest one against whom he has no charge, and whom he does not even suspect, and torture her, contrary to the laws, to force her to give evidence tending to swear away the life of an innocent man, is beyond belief. Where will this end? My husband and my family and myself are the innocent sufferers now, but who will be the next to suffer?
I suppose the witnesses tortured will be confined to the class who are not able to employ lawyers to relieve them from the torture in time to prevent their being forced to give false affidavits. But the lives sworn away may come from any class. It will be noted that the plan is to apply the torture until the desired affidavit is wrung from the sufferer. Then it ends, but not before. It is to be hoped that no person can be convicted of murder in any civilized country on evidence wrung from witnesses by torture. Why, then, does the solicitor continue to apply the third degree to produce testimony? How does he hope to get the jury to believe it? He can have only one hope, and that is to keep the jury from knowing the methods to which he has resorted. Of course, if he can torture witnesses into giving the kind of evidence he wants against my innocent husband in this case, he can torture them into giving evidence against any other man in the community in either this or any other case. I can see only one hope, and that is to let the public know exactly what this officer of the law is doing, and trust, as I do trust, to the sense of fairness and justice of the people. It is not surprising that my cook should sign an affidavit to relieve herself from torture that had been applied to her for 4 hours, according to the Atlanta Constitution, to a point of exhaustion. It would be surprising if she would not, under such circumstances, give an affidavit. This torturing process can be used to produce testimony to be published in the newspapers to prejudice the case of anyone the solicitor sees fit to accuse. It is also valuable to prevent anyone stating facts favorable to the accused, because as soon as the solicitor finds it out, he can arrest the witness and apply the torture. It is hard to believe that practices of this nature will be countenanced anywhere in the world outside of Russia. My husband was at home for lunch, and in the evening, at the hours he has stated on the day of the murder. He spent the whole of Saturday evening and night in my company. Neither on Saturday, nor Saturday night, nor on Sunday, nor at any other time, did my husband, by word or act, or in any other way, demean himself otherwise than as an innocent man. He did nothing unusual, and nothing to arouse the slightest suspicion. I know him to be innocent. There is no evidence against him, except that which is produced by torture. Of course, evidence of this kind can be produced against any human being in the world. I have been compelled to endure, without fault, either on the part of my husband or myself, more than it falls to the lot of most women to bear. Slanders have been circulated in this community to the effect that my husband and myself were not happily married, and every conceivable rumor has been put afloat that would do him and me harm with the public, in spite of the fact that all our friends are aware that these statements are false, and all his friends and myself know that my husband is a man actuated by lofty ideals that forbid his committing the crime that the detectives and the solicitor are seeking to fasten upon him. I know my husband is innocent. No man could make the good husband to a woman that he has been to me and be a criminal. All his acquaintances know he is innocent. Ask every man that knows him, and see if you can find one that will believe he is guilty. If he were guilty, does it not seem reasonable that you could find someone who knows him and will say he believes him guilty? Being a woman, I do not understand the tricks and arts of detectives and prosecuting officers, but I do know Leo Frank, and his friends know him, and I know, and his friends know, that he is utterly incapable of committing the crime that these detectives and this solicitor are seeking to fasten upon him. Respectfully yours, Mrs. Leo M. Frank. This was the first occasion in which the wife of the man charged with the brutal murder of the little factory girl had figured at all prominently in the case. Despite the fact that at the trial the solicitor asserted that she did not go near her husband for 2 weeks after his incarceration, It is known by the writer that she appeared at police headquarters the day he was detained. Friends persuaded her to leave without seeing her husband, who at the time was surrounded by newspaper men and detectives. She did not go to the towers for 2 weeks, as during that time the newspaper camera brigade waited in front of the place for her to appear. Mrs. Frank's statement brought this reply from the solicitor. I have read the statement printed in the Atlanta newspapers over the signature of Mrs. Leo M. Frank, and I have only to say, without in any wise taking issue with her premises, as I might, that the wife of a man accused of crime would probably be the last person to learn all of the facts establishing his guilt, and certainly would be the last person to admit his culpability, even though proved by overwhelming evidence to the satisfaction of every impartial citizen beyond the possibility of reasonable doubt. Since the discovery of this crime, I have rigidly adhered to my consistent policy of refraining from newspaper interviews or statements with relation to the evidence upon which the state must depend to convict and punish the perpetrator of this crime, and it is my purpose to adhere steadfastly to this policy, submitting to the jury of Fulton County citizens to be selected under the fair provision of the law the evidence upon which alone conviction or acquittal must depend. A bill of indictment has been found by the grand jury, composed of impartial and respected citizens of this community, and as Solicitor General of this circuit, charged with the duty of aiding in the enforcement of our laws by the prosecution of those indicted for violating the law, I welcome all evidence from any source that will aid an impartial jury under the charge of the court in determining the guilt or innocence of the accused. Perhaps the most unpleasant feature incident to the position of prosecuting attorney arises from the fact that punishment of the guilty inevitably brings suffering to relations who are innocent of participation in the crime, but who must share the humiliation flowing from its exposure. This, however, is an evil attendant upon crime, and the court and their officers cannot allow their sympathies for the innocent to retard the vigorous prosecution of those indicted for the commission of crime, for were it otherwise, sentiment and not justice would dominate the administration of our laws. Hugh M. Dorsey. While at the time there was considerable sentiment against the solicitor and the detectives, they were not without their backers. Especially was Dorsey lauded for his stand by the laboring people of the city and of the state. The popular sentiment, especially among the working people, continued to grow against Frank. It was charged that the newspapers of Atlanta, because of the insistence of advertisers, were not giving the state a fair deal in the case. Tremendous influences were undoubtedly brought to bear in favor of the accused man, but every move on the part of his friends seemed only to add to the sentiment against him. Sentiment, by this time, was recognized as a powerful factor in the case. The next sensation in the case came when Luther Z. Rosser, Frank's counsel, and a man of few words except in the courtroom, denounced Chief Lanford as insincere in his manhunt and openly charged the crime to Jim Conley.